We talk a lot about the Bible on this podcast, but if you're someone who hasn't read the Bible for yourself before, or if you're someone who wants to go deeper, it can be really helpful to have a Bible study guide to follow. Yarrow Bible Studies can help you grow in your relationship with God and find answers to the questions that are on your mind. Yarrow Studies are very visually inviting, and they give you space for reflection at the same time as guiding you through the Bible so you can know what it says and what it means for your actual life. No matter where you're coming from or what season of life you're in, Yarrow is the Bible study guide that will help you unearth the truth of Scripture so it can take root in your heart and inspire you to go deeper in your relationship with God. Yarrow offers beautifully designed inductive Bible studies and a free digital app. If you're looking for a place to start with Yarrow Studies, why not grab a copy of their first study, Known, which is all about identity in Christ. You can shop at yarrow.org now and save 10% off with the code ConfrontingChristianity10. You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church. I think people legitimately often feel like if I really had faith, what that would look like is me not questioning, rather than maybe saying, actually, if Jesus is real, then he's not fragile. You know, there's no question that we could ask about his life, death, and resurrection, or the implications of that for our world.
I sometimes pay attention to how eagerly we can avoid making eye contact with people. These simple practices of acknowledging the personhood, the presence of another, these are things that Christians should be foremost in.
I'm here with my friend Keith Plummer. Keith serves as Dean and Professor of Theology at the School of Divinity at Cairns University in Pennsylvania. Keith holds a BA in Health and Society from Brown University, an MDiv with an emphasis on apologetics from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and a PhD in Systematic Theology, also from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Keith and I met last April at a conference in New York, where I think we enjoyed chatting most about the ethics of artificial intelligence, Keith. Fair to say? Yeah. Thanks so much for making time to chat with me today.
Sure. Thanks for the invitation. It's good to be with you.
Now, Keith, I haven't known you for long, but I've kind of picked up little snippets of your life from various sources. And one of them was highlighting the fact that relatively early in your Christian development, you went through a period of meaningful doubt yourself. Yes. And I know you said that that's kind of how you personally got interested in the whole field that's sometimes called apologetics, or for those who aren't familiar with that jargon, kind of trying to look carefully at and answer the questions that might lead somebody either away from Christianity who had been raised Christian or keep somebody from even considering Christianity if they're not yet a follower of Jesus. So I'd love for folks to hear, Keith, just more of your story there, maybe how you became a Christian to begin with, and then about this period of doubt and how that got you thinking about some important questions.
I grew up in a church-going home, but it wasn't a Christian home. We attended a church regularly, but it was not somewhere where the Bible was really taught in any great depth. It was much more by way of moralism, be a good person, some activism. But I didn't hear about the necessity of trusting Christ for the forgiveness of sins. And I didn't hear the message of the gospel with any clarity. Hmm. But at the same time, I was going to a very conservative Lutheran parochial school. Hmm. So my mother had sent me there because she figured it was a good education and some religious influence could keep me out of trouble. So I was living in these two worlds. And I became a Christian. Where I trace my conversion to is when I was in college. I was 19 years old. Hmm. And I had grown up singing in the church. And I loved to sing with a choir. And there was this student-led gospel choir called Voices of Inspiration. And I loved the music that they sang. I was friends with a number of the people. And I reluctantly joined. And I say reluctantly because the leadership of this choir, they took the Christian faith seriously. Mm. And they saw this as a ministry. And they encouraged prayer and Bible study and so forth. And I just wanted to sing.
Right.
And so I joined, and nothing was coerced. But I could tell in a relatively short period of time that there was a difference between them and me with respect to singing. It seemed like many of them were singing about someone and to someone that they loved and that they knew. For me, it was simply a matter of performance and the enjoyment of singing. And a number of them could tell that I was spiritually kind of aimless, and they would talk to me about Jesus. And I remember going through a period of time where I was asking questions that I think were manufactured to protect me from the claims of the gospel. And through their perseverance, their prayer, their friendship, their answering of some of the questions that I was asking, I eventually came to the Lord. And I came to the Lord as we were on tour one Christmas break, and we were visiting one of the members' churches, and the pastor gave this message inviting people to trust Jesus for salvation. And I responded, and that was the beginning. That's where I traced my conversion to.
Can I just pause you there a second, Keith, because I'm intrigued. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you went to a Christian high school?
No, I went to a Christian parochial school for kindergarten through eighth grade.
Okay, so a Christian school when you were a little kid.
Yes.
But you didn't actually become a Christian until you went to a big, bad secular university.
Yes.
And okay, I love that.
But if you had asked me prior to that if I was a Christian, I would have said yes.
Okay, yeah.
But it was simply an intellectual assent. I believe God exists. I believe that Jesus died and rose again. But in terms of discipleship, in terms of any obedience, I mean, I was living my life however I wanted to live it. And I didn't really become aware of my guilt and the reality of my being undone and unacceptable to God on the count of my sinfulness until I was in college.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, after I became a Christian, there were these undeniable changes in my life. I mean, first and foremost, there was this sense of being cleansed, being forgiven, that there was this sense of, I am okay with God. And there was a joy that I was experiencing. I had always been somewhat of an innerly restless person, and there was just kind of a calm that had not been there before. There was a voracious appetite for the Bible that I never had before. And I just had such a curiosity and a hunger to read the scriptures. It was certainly not anything that I was manufacturing. It was just foreign to me in terms of my previous life. And then I went through something, and I don't know exactly what precipitated it, but I started down this path of doubt where I began to question everything about the faith. And it was unlike the questions that I was asking on the other side of coming to Christ. Because before, as I said, I was essentially manufacturing doubt in order to shield myself from the claims of Christ. Now, I wanted Christianity to be true, but I was fearful that it wasn't. And I was particularly asking this question of, okay, there are these undeniable changes in my life, but are these just the subjective responses to my believing that Christianity is true, even if it isn't?
Right.
Or are these changes really rooted in reality, in objective truth? And I began to question the existence of God, and from there all else, in terms of, you know, if Jesus existed, was he God incarnate, the possibility of miracles, the inspiration of Scripture? And I just had all of these questions. And unfortunately, many of the people who were Christians longer than me, who were my peers, members of the choir and some others that I knew, they weren't particularly helpful in my dealing with these things. One of my friends said, why don't you just stop thinking about those things? And I said, I would give anything to stop thinking about these things. I just can't turn it off.
Yeah. So Keith, this was all still while you were at Brown as an undergrad. Is that right?
It was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm curious, so I know you studied, was it health and society?
Yes, because I was originally pre-med.
Mm.
And then I did an about face maybe like halfway through. And in order to graduate in time, health and society was the degree that I could take and transfer things over. It was like if you were going to go into public health administration and
right.
or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I was just sort of curious whether part of what was, I guess, pressing on you in various ways to wonder whether, oh, this is all just a kind of subjective experience I've had and not something that's anchored on a objective reality, whether any of that was coming from the things that you were studying or questions that were asked of you by non-Christian friends, or whether this was all sort of purely coming out of you internally.
I can't trace it to any specific event. Something that might have contributed to it, though I had not thought of this before I trusted Jesus, I took a class called Magic, Science, and Religion at Brown.
Wow.
It was a sociological study of religious phenomena. And of course, it was completely naturalistic.
Mm.
And that troubled me, even though I wasn't a follower of Jesus at this point. It troubled me because this was the first time that I began to question whether or not God existed. So I don't know if any of that carried over to the other side of my conversion. I'm not sure. But I felt as though I was at a fork in the road where I was going to have to choose the life of the mind or a vibrant faith. And I remember being in my dorm room and just being prostrate on my floor, praying and saying, I don't even know if I'm talking to anyone, but if you were there, please help me. I felt like I was in a fork in the road between the life of the mind and a vibrant faith, because I had always been academically inclined. I had always been intellectually curious. And I thought that I might be in a situation where I was going to have to choose.
Mm.
And either I was going to have this vibrant, robust faith, or I was going to be mindful of intellectual considerations, in which case I would have to abandon that.
Mm.
And that was just a very painful time in my life. I call it a hellish period of my life, going through that period of doubt. And at the time, I'm originally from New York. And so there was a summer where I was in New York, and there was a Christian bookstore near the Times Square area that at the time was New York's largest Christian bookstore. And I used to visit it quite frequently. And I remember going down an aisle and seeing a book that was about five evangelical leaders, something like that. And I saw the pictures on the cover, and some of the people I recognized, like Billy Graham and J.I. Packer. But there was this one man whose picture was just so curious to me because he seemed so distinct in his appearance. It was odd. Odd is the word that I use. And I didn't know who it was. And so I just picked up the book to find out who this man was. And it turned out to be Francis Schaeffer. Mm. And as I was thumbing through and I was reading about him and the ministry that he and his wife Edith had at Le Brie in Switzerland, and how it is that he was concerned about reaching people who were asking the big questions about life, people who were disillusioned Christians, people who were involved in existentialist philosophy, the drug culture, but who were asking questions about what is life about, what's real, what's true, and so forth. I remember standing in that aisle in that bookstore and tears coming to my eyes.
Wow.
Because here was someone who was taking seriously the kinds of questions that were causing me so much pain.
Mm.
And showing how it is that this fork in the road that I thought that I was going to have to choose as to which path to take wasn't necessarily so.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my introduction to Francis Schaeffer. And he, through his writings, because by the time that I had discovered his writings, he had gone to be with the Lord. But he was a real, real, I say, a stream in my spiritual desert.
Mm.
And that was one of the major factors that was used to get me interested in apologetics.
Yeah, yeah. My sense is, Keith, that you're not the only young Christian who's been told, well, maybe you just need to not think so hard,
or
you know, stop asking those questions and just believe. I think that's a message that a lot of people have heard, and one where I think people legitimately often feel like, oh, if I really had faith, what that would look like is me not questioning.
Right.
Rather than maybe saying, actually, if Jesus is real, then he's not fragile. You know, there's no question that we could ask about his life, death, and resurrection, or the implications of that for our world, that is going to kind of make Jesus shatter in our hands. And that really, I think it's often more helpful for people to sort of switch that around and say, do you know what? I can ask any and all questions. I can lean into exploring and using my mind to the fullest extent.
Yes.
And I'm not going to find Jesus to be lacking in that process.
Yes. So I soon got the complete works of Francis Schaeffer, and I started working through it. And that was just such a help to me, particularly how he was showing how the Christian faith provided the necessary foundations for things that we take for granted in terms of morality, or even the ability to know the correspondence between our minds and the world outside of our minds. And I so appreciated the fact that he was listening to culture and seeking to provide what he called honest answers to honest questions.
Yeah.
And I thrived on that. And I remember praying that if God would use me in the lives of other people as he used Schaeffer in mine, how grateful I would be. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean with respect to the scope of his audience or notoriety or anything. I had just been so genuinely helped by him.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be part of that in the lives of others. So to be able to, you know, teach apologetics as I do every semester, I take as an answer to that prayer, and I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And Keith, one of the differences between when you or I were in college and the experience of many college students today is that whereas you went with your questions to a bookshop and sort of picked up a book or had conversations with friends, that today, because so much of our public square, our information sourcing, and even our sense of community comes from online spaces, that actually students are more likely to kind of Google than go to a bookstore on it. And I'm not saying that with any kind of, you know, judgment, but I'm curious for your thoughts on how that reality has changed how students, or, you know, anybody really, but like especially those at a formative stage in their lives, kind of exploring their beliefs, how that online experience is changing how students are thinking, and how you as a Christian think about your own engagement in the public square of the internet.
Yes. I think for many students, the inundation with all of the sources of information that are at their fingertips can have the effect on some of just kind of they're losing hope that there is any knowable truth. I think the proliferation of information has many good things about it, but I think it can be oftentimes stifling and crippling, because it just seems so overwhelming. How could anyone ever know, in the midst of all of this discord and competing narratives and explanations? And another side of that, I think, is you can also find whatever you would like to find there to confirm the things that you might already be disposed towards. In addition to, yes, there are valuable sources that are out there as well. So I think that depending upon the person, there are a number of ways that can impact them. But I think for many, whether it's young people or even older individuals, it can foster a sense of kind of a despair, and maybe even a skepticism as to any claims to truth.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort, and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold. Yeah. No, I think that's very real. I think I've seen sort of both the most positive and the most negative ends of this in different people's experience. And I think positively of a young woman I've recently met who first heard the gospel through a beauty YouTuber. I didn't even know what that was, but apparently it's somebody you follow for makeup tips on YouTube, which I perhaps could use, but I've never gone that way. And yeah, that was her first experience of the gospel was hearing from this woman who decided to share her testimony online on her kind of her platform. And this young woman was just like moved to tears by what she heard about Jesus. So there are ways in which clearly people do encounter real transformative truth about the Lord online. And on the other hand, not only so many kind of demonstrably false claims, actually, even before we've got into questions that could be matters of interpretation, you know, there's so much kind of actual falsehood proliferated on the internet. But also, I think it's fair to say that many, as they look to, you know, social media in particular, see perhaps both the best and the worst of how Christians conduct themselves in online spaces. And I'm curious for your thoughts on that, Keith. I know this is something that you've sort of thought more in depth about, like how the ways that we relate online relate or don't relate to how we might interact with actual human beings in in real time and space close to us. Yeah, I'm curious for your thoughts on that.
Well, I wrote something on this in a book called The Digital Public Square, and I drew upon one of Schaeffer's works where it was a short paper, it was a talk that he gave at the Lausanne Congress on evangelization, and it was called Two Contents and Two Realities. And Schaeffer said that if the world was going to be one, if the church was going to have any impact, there were four things that were necessary. Two of them he called contents. And by that, he meant sound doctrine, sound biblically based teaching. And the second content was honest answers to honest questions, that the church had to be equipped to meet people where they were and to take seriously the questions that they were asking and to be ready to answer them patiently and with informed minds. I think the internet is very good for those two things in terms of content. But another thing that Schaeffer said, the realities that he had in mind, he said the first reality is true spirituality. And people who have any knowledge of Schaeffer know that he wrote a book by that title that came out of his own period of doubt once he was deep in ministry. And what caused his doubt was he said that there was a lack of reality in his own life. The spiritual fervor that he once knew was not there. And he was part of an Orthodox community, church-wise, where he said, there doesn't seem to be a reality by way of holiness and love. And he said, it led him to consider whether he needed to go back to his agnosticism. And he went through this period of real introspection and study. And he said, if I do come out of the end of this and am convinced that Christianity isn't true, I am going to go back to my agnosticism. And the Lord did do some wonderful things in his life. And the book True Spirituality was really born out of that experience in his life. By true spirituality, he meant that union with Christ is to be lived out in the believer's life by this moment-by-moment dependence upon the indwelling Holy Spirit, through whom the fruit of Christ would be born in believers' lives. The other reality that he had in mind, he called the beauty of relationship. And he said that Christians should be those who practice the beauty of relationships first, because everyone that we encounter is a bearer of the image of God, and therefore there should be a giving of honor and dignity, regardless of the socioeconomic, the racial, the intellectual, religious differences that we might have. He said, we should be those who practice the beauty of relationship, because we believe, we confess, that humans are image bearers of God. But then also, he said, Christians amongst themselves should especially be showing the beauty of relationship as brothers and sisters in Christ. And he said that that love, that demonstrable love, was the final or the ultimate apologetic.
Yeah, which obviously is precisely what Jesus said, right?
You know, this exactly.
Is how people will know you're my disciples, because of your love for one another.
Yes, and he prays for our unity so that the world would know that the Father had sent him. And, you know, that intrigues me often, because that's not so much an argument. That's not a propositional argument, but it is evidence. So when I think about the internet, I think, okay, the internet is a very helpful medium for communicating the content. It's less helpful, or it's more limited in terms of the realities that Schaefer was talking about, in terms of that being displayed. So my concern is always that Christians don't prioritize the virtual life to such an extent that it's at the exclusion of real community. And by community, I mean we're now at a place where we use the word community in a variety of expanded ways. But I do believe that community presupposes, in its truest sense, proximity and presence and place. And I think we need to be thinking about, how is it that we can give more opportunities for unbelievers to behold, to witness Christians demonstrating what Schaefer is talking about, true spirituality, the beauty of relationships. But to the extent that we can display those things virtually, and I think it is limited, what really concerns me is the vitriol and the lack of beauty with which Christians are often interacting with, speaking about one another before the eyes of the world online.
Yeah, I think I absolutely share that concern. And I think one of the edges of it as well, so there's how Christians are often speaking about one another, and then there's how Christians are often speaking about or engaging with those who might legitimately be called ideological enemies, you know, people who might be very hostile to Christianity for whatever reason. And it seems to me that often we forget that Jesus very specifically said, love your enemies.
Exactly.
Like our posture toward, if we're followers of Jesus, our posture toward those who might be most hostile to us is not sort of mutual aggression or even toleration, actually. It's love.
Yes.
And I think one of the negatives of online spaces is so often we see kind of fighting fire with fire from Christians and a kind of active hostility. But I guess on the positive end of that spectrum, I personally find real opportunities sometimes online. You know, if somebody does attack me, to think, okay, my first impulse might be to fight back. But if I sit for a moment and remember that I'm a follower of Jesus, and then think, okay, how can I show and model love toward this person? I think there are real opportunities for that, for a distinctiveness.
Yes, there are. And I think that is so foreign to most online discourse that causes people to take note.
Yeah. Which, if we're Christians, it's truly sad if that's unusual. You know, like I said, we're being flat disobedient to the Lord if that's not our bread and butter.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm curious, Keith, so you mentioned the importance of prioritizing kind of what we might call embodied community, individuals and groups of people with whom we can have routine, physically grounded interactions. Mm-hmm. What does that look like in your own life? And how would you recommend someone who's maybe either considering Christianity or sort of at an early stage in their Christian life, what kinds of lived community would you recommend that people seek out and foster and build?
Well, I think the scriptures talk about there's a warning that is given to Christians not to neglect the gathering of ourselves together, which I take as meaning more than just simply showing up for church, though I mean, that's part of it. But there is this sense of the recognition that this drifting away from others is a habit. It can be a habit. Mm. The author says, as is the habit of some. And so I think small things like determining to be fully present where I am. And I'm not saying this is someone who has mastered this, but these are the kinds of things that I think about. It's not very uncommon for any of us to engage in the technical term, I think is called fubbing.
Yeah, when, right.
when you're with someone, but you're paying attention to your phone at the same time, or maybe even more so. So, I think about things like, I don't want to do that. I want to practice being present for another and with another when I'm with them.
Yeah.
And not allowing myself to fall into what even might be socially acceptable distraction.
Mm, yeah.
So that's a small thing. Getting together with people when there is the opportunity to do it, as opposed to what is the fastest or most efficient way, as I might think it. So for example, and now these are really small things, but I think these are things that we've got to start there because we have become so enculturated in other ways. Sending an email to someone that I work with might be the quickest thing to do. Hmm. But going and walking to their office to ask them what I want, or just to request something of them, that's not the most efficient. Sometimes I think it is the most efficient because right. You're not going yeah. you're not going back and forth at this, thread of emails, and you could just get it done in one setting. But efficiency isn't the first and foremost, it shouldn't be the first and foremost value. Mm. Neither should speed, because relationships and love do require time, and they're not always efficient.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we've got to be thinking about what are the values by which I'm making the decisions that I am relationally. And so I spoke with a young man who said that he had been away from the church for 9 years. Hmm. He had grown up in a Christian family, but when he reached a certain age, he just drifted away. There wasn't anything that was particularly traumatic or upsetting. He just drifted away. He worked with a young man who is a believer who just invited him to church.
Yeah.
And he accepted. Mm-hmm. And he said that was the beginning of taking my faith more seriously and my taking the church more seriously. And so whether it is extending the invitation to people, or if on the other side, someone who's a non-Christian is listening to this, accepting an invitation just to see what it is about, I think these are all ways that we can practice the goodness of presence. Another thing, and this might sound small again, but I really believe that this is critical. I'm at a university campus, and I sometimes pay attention to how eagerly we can avoid making eye contact with people.
Hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it is because we're looking at our phone or so forth. But I think especially on the other side of COVID and some of the things that we have been dealing with, these simple practices of acknowledging the personhood, the presence of another, these are things that Christians should be foremost in.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that regard, I just said that, and I think of like a resource, especially for believers, that I would recommend is Alan Noble's Disruptive Witness. Hmm. on this point, because he says in that book, the two major obstacles that Christians have to contend with in our time in terms of people being willing to hear the gospel are secularism and distraction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. It's huge. Yeah, I think of a young woman who recently became a Christian and started coming to our church and delightfully shared a few days ago. She said, oh, I've realized that you guys actually have to love me. Like, there's no, you don't have an option of saying, do you know what? Like, for whatever reason, we're tired of you or whatever. You have to love me. And it was just a beautiful moment of realization, sort of be able to sit alongside somebody having that kind of light bulb go off of, oh, this is the one place, this is the one community that I can show up in where everybody has to love me. Mm. And I think that's something which, as if you're a Christian listening to this, just as a reminder and encouragement that it is our job to love one another and to love those who might just show up for whatever reason or be around us. And maybe also an encouragement if you're not a Christian and you're listening to this and sort of exploring Christianity, you're curious about it, try showing up to a Christian gathering. And my hope is that the people there will recognize that they actually have to love you. And I think that's probably what we all most deeply want and can experience, albeit in a very imperfect way, as a collection of sinners. So I guess the other truth about every church is it's going to be a collection of sinners, and every Christian you meet, every Christian gathering you participate in, informal or formal, will be filled with sinful people.
Oh, yes.
But sinful people who have to love one another and have to love you.
Yes. And on that point, I mean, I would invite those who are not followers of Christ yet to consider the question, why is it that we all want those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is it that we want to be loved? Why is it that we want to be heard? Why is it that we have these desires and these yearnings? And what story best answers those questions about who and what we are? And from a Christian standpoint, we would say, you know, we are the creation of a triune God who has always existed in love and communication. We're made in his image. And there is a yearning within us for relationship.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful place for us to end, Keith. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Confronting Christianity podcast. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram, or you can leave us a review on iTunes if you would like to. You can also include a question there that you would like to see explored in a future episode, and we will take that into consideration. Please join me next week when I'll be interviewing a friend who's written a book on the surprising genius of Jesus, and especially focused actually on a story that Jesus tells, which exhibits precisely the kind of seeking love that Keith has been mentioning. Until then.